So today the date is April 13th, and the panel is Piggy Banks, Student Loans, and 401ks, Teaching Financial Survival. That's the name of the panel. I'm the moderator. My name is Sasha Millstone, and I am a financial planner and investment advisor. And in my spare time, I am the president of the board of a nonprofit that works on financial literacy for students, particularly middle school and high school students. And we do that by, our whole mission is really to get students who are young to be really excited about the concept of financial literacy and think it's a really cool subject that they should know more of. So we use bands. We have three different bands that tour the country: hip hop, singer-songwriter with a little country flair, and rock and roll. And they go, and we get them into schools, and we pay for the shows, and they do a mini concert, and then the mini concert is followed by the band telling their story, and like the good decisions they made about money, and the decisions that they wish they would have done differently, where they made mistakes, and weaving in six or seven basic financial concepts. The idea is when we are done, when we leave that school, the kids will want to learn more and not think that it's a boring old topic that, you know, just old people care about. So we have a really interesting group of panelists. And by the way, on this panel, everyone, including me, this is our first year doing the conference on literacy. Yes.
Hopefully not the last.
Okay, so Nathan Nguyen. Nathan is the father of two daughters, 3 and 1 year old. And being a father has given Nathan a new perspective on the importance of financial literacy. As you'll hear later, Nathan has been very aware of the importance of financial literacy for his whole life. But being a father has given him new urgency on how important it is for the next generation to understand money and finance. Nathan has been an entrepreneur since graduating from high school. And by the time he graduated college, he was already being interviewed on television. It was a program, a segment that was highlighting young, successful college millionaires. So he's also a best-selling author of a book called Money Smarts and a Game Craver. So, let's see. Matea.
Close enough. Matea
Goljar is from Slovenia, and he's been working with youth. Fascinating story. He's been working with one of the biggest accelerator programs in the world, really, of students. Every single student in the program is an entrepreneur and starts their own company. And something that really leveraged his ability to reach more kids was coming here. He attended the Unreasonable Institute here in 2014. And that is what got him funding on a scale to expand this program internationally. So there's over 5,000 companies that are in existence because of your programs.
I apologize. I don't have the right name.
John Haveman. John is also new here. John also felt that John is an economist, and his mission is to have more people in this country understand economic policy and how it relates to their daily lives. And interestingly, as a father of an 11-year-old son, being a father has given him even more urgency in this mission. So John started his nonprofit, which is called the National Economic Education Delegation, a year and a half ago. And he told me he's the foolish founder of this of this nonprofit, the goal of which is to increase economic policy literacy. So please welcome all of our panelists. Okay, so Nathan, do you want to talk, just give
sure.
your opening?
Yeah, so first of all, students, raise your hand. I always like to recognize other students. Round of applause for all the students that's here. You know what I wish? I wish the university would be passing out $100 bills at the door, encouraging more students to come to this type of session. Yeah. Because it's going to really directly mm-hmm. relate to them and help them. Because wouldn't the university be really proud to know that their alumni are going to be financially successful to donate back to the university? So I would encourage, so if you anybody have connections to the dean, and let them know. You should be passing out bills just to have it come to the session. And then you will see your endowment funds increasing, you know, future investment in the future generation. So that's what I would like to start out with. And for me, thank you so much for inviting me to be here. As she, Sasha, shared, this is a passion topic of mine. Because I believe when students or any individual can become financially literate, I came from, you know, I immigrated here from Vietnam when I was 5 years old, and we youngest of six, we struggled financially all our lives. And one of the reasons why was because we were financially illiterate. It wasn't until I, 12 years old was when I, you know, my mom and dad was invited to a trip to go to Rome and couldn't end up going, that's when I asked him, you know, what prevented you? And it was because of money. And for me, later on, she said, well, even if we did have the money, we want to make sure we have for you. And that hurt me because my dad was a POW, was in prison, a prisoner of war for 10 years because of the Vietnam War. The last thing I wanted was to be another financial prison for my parents in America. And so I wanted to help my family and take responsibility. And that's when I went on my journey to become financially literate and get myself financially educated throughout college. And that's where it got my start in financial education. And so I'm glad to be here to be able to share my experiences of what I've learned in the process.
John?
Were we giving our whole 5 minutes, or that was just an intro? Okay.
Freestyle it.
So thanks everybody for coming on a slightly snowy Saturday morning. As mentioned, I am an economist, and my organization is NEED, the National Economic Education Delegation, because I think we need more economic policy literacy. That's a cousin to financial literacy. And I'm a little bit of a competitor in people's learning space. But that's not to diminish the importance of financial literacy. A long time ago, I was introduced to the notion of compound interest when somebody asked me this question: would you rather have $1 million today or a penny that doubles every day for 30 days? Right? The answer to that appears to be really obvious. You know, $1 million today. Well, it turns out a penny that doubles every day for 31 days, that's worth $10 million. Right, just an exaggerated way of expressing the notion of compound interest. So I think it's really important that we bring financial literacy into the schools so that people can take ownership of their personal financial space, finances. You know, what to understand what does it mean to have a massive student loan. Right? I argue that it doesn't mean what the students coming out of school think it means. It's not this great tragedy. It's not this thing to be terrified of. But they have no context, right? That's the first loan that they experience, and sometimes it's really big. And second is, you know, what does it mean to not pay off your credit card every month? What does it mean to only pay the minimum balance due? To understand your financial capacity. Right? Here's the trajectory that you're headed off on, and what does that mean for your finances going forward? You know, your salary might be low today, but you might have great prospects. You know, should you borrow money to borrow beyond your current means, or should you be more careful? What kind of a personal safety net do you need? I don't think that people have a fundamental understanding of, you know, someday something bad might happen financially and I ought to have some reserves. I do understand that there are people who are in a position, not in a position to create reserves. But I often ask the question, you know, even there, is it restricted ability, or is it because they just don't understand that, you know, putting away a few dollars here and there can really come in handy at some point? Without that knowledge, it's actually trouble for broader society. Right? I was just talking to Nathan about my experience buying a home in 2000 in the Bay, San Francisco Bay Area, in I think it was 2002. Right, I kept my realtor kept pushing me towards $1 million, $1.5 million homes, and I kept pushing back to $600,000, $700,000 homes, and she kept saying, "But you can qualify for so much more." And I kept telling her, "Yes, I understand that. It's a matter of paying it off, and when that loan balloons up in 3 or 5 years, I might not be able to pay it. I'm an economist; I understand this." But so many people didn't. So many people didn't. Right, taking out loans that were well beyond any reasonable capacity, right? And I blame, you know, financial illiteracy combined with greed or the willingness to exploit that financial illiteracy with the mortgage meltdown. Right? Had everybody understood what it means to take out a $1 million loan when you make $25,000 a year, right, we might not have ended up where we did. Yeah. And I mentioned vulnerable families. In the last panel I was on, somebody mentioned the fact that apparently 46% of people when polled could not come up with $400, yeah, right? Which is staggering to me. Mm-hmm. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the five W's and add the how in there, who, what, why, where, when, and how, as sort of my prescription and my thinking about financial literacy, right? What is teaching financial literacy, right, as part of the core? Right? I'm going to make the case that it's, well, I try to make the case that it's fundamental. Why? Partly for broader economic stability. It's in all of our best interests to, in fact, spend a little bit more money so that they get that. Another why, there are a bunch of obvious whys, but another one is stress reduction. Right? How many surveys come out with, you know, what's the trouble spot in your marriage? Right. Well, money is at least one of the top two, right? And I don't know for sure, but it seems reasonable to me that if people were better at managing their finances, it wouldn't be that big of an issue. How, right? How is a big deal, because, you know, if you ask any teacher, there isn't time enough in the day to teach what they want to now. But I often argue, well, okay, let's extend the day. My child is in school from 8:45 to 3:25, which is really impractical on one level for two-parent families. But, you know, so throw a little bit more recess in there. You can also throw in a little bit more time of instruction. Okay, yes, that's going to cost more money, but let's pay it. Or, you know, perhaps more practical is interweaving it with everything else that they're learning. Right? Interweave it with the math that they're learning, with the reading that they're learning, with the writing that they're learning. Seems perfectly feasible to me. You know, where, anywhere people are being educated, right? You know, I've got down here public schools. Well, why public schools only, not private schools? You know, just everywhere people are getting educated. When? Right? That's an important question. When? Should we start in high school? Should we start in middle school? Should we start in elementary school? I would be shocked if we couldn't come up with ways of interweaving it into kindergarten, mm-hmm, right? And can create games that sort of introduce the fundamental notions and concepts. And then another important question and hard question is who? Because it's not clear that our teachers have the wherewithal to teach it. So do we send our teachers back to school? Do we bring in specialists? I think probably a little bit of both. Again, it's going to cost more money, but I think it's worth it. I'm sort of financially literate enough to know that it's going to be worth it. Yeah. And from an economics perspective, it's a matter of what are the priorities in school, right? We talk about in economics equalizing marginal benefit, right? And I don't think that that's done at all. That's another way of sort of asking the question: is it more important to teach a child how to dissect a triangle than it is to teach them how to understand compound interest? Right. I think you know what my answer is to that. Right, and in schools, we teach reading, writing, and math as fundamental. And there's a big push, and I don't think it's a bad push, to bring in what's now evolved into STEAM from STEM, yeah. Right? Science, technology, engineering, arts, and math, right? To put an emphasis on those things. Well, why? An F doesn't fit very well in the word STEAM, but why not financial literacy? Why is financial literacy, which is going to be fundamental to everybody throughout the rest of their lives? Engineering, maybe not. Technology, maybe not. Right? Financial literacy is going to be fundamental to succeeding in life. So why don't we put F in there with STEAM? I'm going to close just by emphasizing that, you know, reading is fundamental, sure. We don't want to shirk on that, but financial literacy is also fundamental, and we are shirking on it.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. Just to tack on there, just the research shows, and you're probably aware of this, that you can start teaching these concepts at 3 years old. And there's only 17 states that have any kind of financial literacy requirement right now, and that hasn't changed in 4 years. And yeah. Another big issue, just I'm sure you're very aware of, is that when you do make a requirement, the teachers have to be comfortable teaching the subject. Unfortunately, yeah. Many are not. Mm. So, good yeah. Openings, yes. What's
so, let me start by basically acknowledging the privilege of being on this stage and at this conference this week. What's really magical about, you know, convening in this type of way is that we get to open a debate and hopefully even get to some conclusions. What's really special is that there are experts here and there are non-experts who can also share an opinion. Now, in all honesty, of all the panels that I've did, this one in particular, I cannot really consider myself to be an expert. I had to Google what's 401k just before walking up on here. Why? Because I live in a country that is called Slovenia and that basically has a couple of things that are probably completely foreign to yours. And so I am feeling a little bit of an alien here. Why? Well, you know, it's really cool to talk about financial literacy, but if the bag is empty, what am I going to be literate about? I live in a place where school is free. I live in a place where healthcare is free. I live in a place where the government gives you, allocates you a house when you are a student and you pay $100 for it a month. And any restaurant in my hometown that I go to as a student, I will have 50% off for every meal all the time while I am studying. So you can see that my perspective here is a little bit skewed. And what I wanted basically to do this is, what I'm seeing at this panel is that there's four people who all of us have started social ventures, interventions that in some context try to prepare the students for the future. There's an economist, there are two people who are doing financial literacy, and I'm a business person, I'm an entrepreneur. We all agree. However, for this debate to be fun, what I want to do now is basically open up with a very direct provocation and a challenge. And that challenge being, what the fuck are you talking about? You're saying that it's not a tragedy that people end up leaving education with $200,000 in debt? I mean, look at Scandinavia. Look at our part of the world. There is a reason why we are happier, why we are healthier, why we have more free time, and why we have better interpersonal relationships. I agree with you completely. Money is at the core of basically making problems for you personally. Now, there is a lot of things that can be done by individuals, yes, and we teach most of them as well to our students. But individual can only push you so far. The other part is, this is really a place where the education system, where the welfare system, where the state, and where the society also does its fair share. So to conclude my presentation, I want to do something a little bit stupid and basically cross off my name. And for the rest of this discussion, please, let's say that you will call me a communist. With a smile at the end. Not to say that I disagree with my colleagues panelists, but I will try to argue the communist view for this particular hour. Thank you so much.
Are you old enough to have been an actual
communist? Oh, yeah. Okay. 3 years of my life I have lived in communism.
Do you want to just maybe talk for one minute on the communist perspective on entrepreneurial activities that you're starting?
Absolutely, and that's a phenomenal question, yeah. So the first time I came to Boulder, and this is the unreasonable story, there's this social venture from Slovenia teaching people how to do business. So in the Daily Camera, there was an article, "Communist comes to America to teach about business." Now, in all seriousness, I am seeing a convergence between the capitalist idea and the communist idea. Let's remember what Karl Marx said about communism. The end goal is, very simply, to enable every worker to have in its control the means for production. With that being said, that every worker also has access to capital, access to all the resources, and everything else that's needed for a livelihood. Today we live in a gig economy. Today the livelihood that we think about is created with internet, with a laptop, with being literate online, being financially literate, and basically having the time to execute on your skill. My sense is that both of these two ideas share the same goal and are not as different as as we might think. What is different, though, is that communism has become a bad word just as much as it has become a bad word to increase the taxes, to increase the size of the state, and to basically do what needs to be done and have the schools free.
Thank you. So I'm going to ask a couple of questions. I wanted to remind everybody that we're using both the CWI...
John wants to respond.
Can I respond just a little bit?
Yes, I would like you to.
Let's make the question announcement.
But anyway, we're using the app and also the note card system. So you can do either one, but we'd love you to use the app. And if you do use the app and you're a student, let me know that you're a student, please. What you do is you select this session in your app in the schedule, and then you tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. And you can also raise your hand and do the postcards. So, yes, would you like to respond, John?
I want to start by saying that I love Slovenia. I've been going to Slovenia every year for the last 15 or 16 years. It's a fantastic place. Having said that, I want to point out that... What you just heard from the communist, from Mattia, that, you know, how a school is free, right? He gets subsidized housing, he gets subsidized meals, healthcare is free in Slovenia. And I want you, every time you talk about providing those kinds of services here and the person you're talking to says, "We can't afford it," I want you to remember that you heard somebody from Slovenia, which is a very economically successful country, but we are richer than Slovenia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We can afford it. We choose not to.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's number one. Number two, I agree with you. You know, $200,000 in student, that's a problem. But I think student loans of an order of magnitude less, but still large, it's not an enormous problem because education is such a phenomenal investment. I do think that it would be better if they weren't saddled with the loans that they're saddled with, but I don't think it's the crisis that it tends to be made out to be. That's all I have for now.
Well, we'll come back for more. Nathan, I heard in your introduction that you came from a community that was struggling financially, and it seems like it gave you even more motivation to do what you are doing now and to be so successful. Are you working with those disadvantaged communities now? And do you talk about, if you are, can you talk about what
Sure.
you're doing now, please?
So to continue the story and to directly answer your question first, and then I'll get back to the story. Yeah, so I locally teach at a local high school for a group of seniors to help them with a career pathway and also give them financial education so that they have the confidence and the ability to pursue, to financially succeed pursuing any career pathways as well as coming from any backgrounds. So the first thing I like to share is in schools, we teach accounting. And we think that's teaching financial literacy. Accounting is counting other people's money. Right? And then you go into college, managerial accounting. Now you're managing other people's money. Great. But then there's no class to teach personal finance. You know, we talked in the last economic panel, I believe national economic health is rooted from home economic health. But home economics is deleted from our educational curriculum, which is a big tragedy. It's a big crisis. We look at teaching life skills as something as secondary to technical skills, which is also questionable as well. Mm-hmm. How do we equal the level playing field for those that are in the working or middle class, where I came from welfare? I believe is you give them education, but you give them the skills, life skills, like such. So one of the things I teach, and that's hopefully will be helpful, is just a change in perspective of money. Being in business and an entrepreneur, I learn a lot about financial statements. But what's interesting is, from a personal standpoint, in business, we can't operate, or just think about, imagine a business where at the end of the month, we say, profit is optional. It's a luxury to have profits at the end of the month. You take income minus expense, oh, it would be great to have profit. No, that business will be out of business next month. But in our everyday lives, we call that income minus expenses. We call that savings. Savings is optional. It's a luxury. It's not mandatory. If you don't save, it's okay. Use your credit card. Load up on debt. But then if we treat ourselves as individual businesses, me, Inc., we would never, ever put profit as after, you know, it's we would only save after what we spend, right? But that's the problem. We should always have the goal of how much we're going to save, how much profit we're going to have, and then we'll spend what's left. But now it's like, no, we just spend as much as we like emotionally and to have these short-term gratifications versus delaying all that. So that's the first thing I believe. Yeah. The second thing about helping the you know, they say wealth inequality. There's this chart that I look. America's wealth inequality 2017, 76.7% of wealth is controlled by the top 10% of Americans, leaving less than 25% of wealth to the rest of the 90% of Americans. And I thought, maybe that's the wrong stats. Maybe look at maybe because America is the rich country. Let's look at the world. It got even more depressing. 90% of the world's wealth is controlled by the top 10%. Leaving only 10% of the world's wealth, the remaining 90. So I looked at that chart and I said, what makes those who have the wealth and those who don't, what causes that? What do they know that I don't? What do I need to learn that they already know? And it comes down to financial education. You can't have money if you don't know money. It just comes down to that common sense. But common sense is a common practice. And that's the problem. So at the end of the day, what I found out was education is the first thing. Next, we have knowledge is one side, but it will fall. So a lot of financial literacy programs don't work. Because here's another aspect. It's called skill. Knowledge and skill, then you got something that can actually be sustainable. So how can we teach financial skills to students in the young generation? Is by giving them responsibilities. Yeah. Too often, the older generation, we do it for them, out of love, care, and protecting them. Yes. But because we don't empower them to make these decisions, financial decisions, no skills. And right now, the stats is parents. When you ask students, who do you look up to? Who do you learn financial skills from? Parents. But then you survey the parents, 69% of them says that I'm not comfortable or adequate enough to talk about it. parents are more comfortable talking about sex and drugs to their kids than money. And people are more open about their sex life than their financial life. So that just tells you why people struggle with just money. And so that becomes what I would like to share. And then parents then say, leave it to the educators. Leave it to the schools to teach. And then you survey the educators. Over 60% says, I'm not qualified and I'm struggling myself. A story was, there was we were doing a quick fundraiser at one of our local school. The student came in and said, Mr. Nguyen, I think I did something bad. I said, what'd you do? I made a teacher cry. Like, how would you make a teacher cry? I asked her for a $25 donation, and she wept. She says, I'm so sorry. I simply don't have the financial means. And I said, boy, if our future is our kids, and it's in the hands of educators, we need to take care of our educators better, and we need to equip them with financial confidence and competence. Yes.
Pay them a living wage.
Yeah. And maybe jumping onto this, I think you make the most important point. The specific problem that happened was where the young generation is basically moved away from these decisions. And, you know, maybe it takes an extreme example to notice the problem. Picture communism. Picture my country. Picture me as a kid. My mom was actually a member of the Communist Party, legit. She now has a company and doing basically what you're doing, which is even more weird. Nice shift. But anyways, there's this saying in our country, never talk about money on the at the table. And that means, like, you literally never do it. Never ask anyone how much they're making. Never ask anyone how much profit they're making when they're selling something. The least profit, the better. So this is an ingrained perception that basically results in what you're describing. And it's really scary that we're seeing it now all over the world because of the good intentions of the parents to just push them away. So the parents don't want to do it, the school doesn't want to do it, the kids end up watching YouTube video of funny cats. The problem that we now have is how can we change this? And I would like to implore the parents to do basically the same thing that our mentors do with their kids. There was this interesting discussion with all of our mentors that teach business. How can we encourage our kids who are typically like kindergarten age? We're a young team. And what we ended up discussing and agreeing on doing was we don't do pocket money anymore. Instead, what we do is we encourage the kids to go around the house and think about things they can improve. Like, mommy, I'm seeing that you haven't done this and this. Would you give me $1 to do it? And then you basically encourage them to think about proactive problem solving on one hand. On the other hand, you're basically seeing that there needs to be an effort made for you to get money in. And it's those types of small interventions that are going to change the wider problem. And this is something that it's basically a decision, like you said. At this stage in time, we need to collectively decide what we want to do with this generation. It's easy for me to say Slovenia is a small country and we are basically covering about a third of the school system. We're going to solve Slovenia unless there is a big economic crisis and basically we all end up, you know, not having a job. What is to be done in America? I don't know. I would love to hear what you think about it.
So, yeah, I think this concept that you guys are talking about is, this is how you start at three, is you think about the different activities that you do. You go to the grocery store with your kids, you have them in the cart, and you start involving them in the decisions. At a very young age, you start teaching them about saving and actually also about charitable giving. You just start the concepts at a very early age, and there's an author named Nancy Phillips who's actually written storybooks for little kids that she has three different ones that actually do that in the story, and you know, it's very effective. John, you may have some ideas about games as well, because I know you mentioned it, on teaching younger kids.
I wish I did.
Okay.
I'm mostly focused on adults these days.
Okay, so we have some good questions from the audience. The reason I mentioned that is that was one of the questions, when do you start teaching young people to care? Kids are very interested in money, and they understand money, what it is, you know, at a very young age, and they're fascinated by it. They like to count it. And, I mean, it's really not a difficult thing to get your kid interested in doing at a very young age. So, practically speaking, what should I know about my 100,000 of student loans, and how could that be taught more broadly? John, do you want to start on that?
So my thinking specifically with regard to student loans is what I mentioned, just that tends to be a young person's first experience with debt. And if it's big, that can be paralyzing, mm-hmm. right? And if you enter into that arrangement and you come out of college and suddenly you've got this debt and you don't have an understanding of what it means, it can be paralyzing. It can cause you to put off decisions that maybe you should, but maybe you don't need to. It can really fundamentally alter your life. So more what I'm talking about is finding some way of leading kids up to the notion that, well, you might have this big debt, and yes, it's going to put constraints on your life, but it should not be paralyzing, and here's how you deal with it, work around it, and pay it.
So I guess in that question, the word that was being emphasized in the beginning was practically. So I'm going to give you some practical things about. First of all, there's so much that a person can save. I mean, the fact that you have this debt, you got to pay it off. So practically, you got to pay it off over 10 years, 20 years. And the great thing about it is you can negotiate that, and if you can also ask forbearance. So practically speaking, if you're struggling to pay it off, call and don't avoid. Let them know what your situation, and they will help you. The fact that you owe them $100,000, you own them. If you owe $100,000, you own them. They want to be nice to you. And if they disrespect you, say, hey, look, speak to me nicely, then I'll pay. Speak to me with respect, then I'll pay. Trust me, they'll treat you nicely because you owe them $100,000, so then you own them. That's the first of all. So don't be afraid of the repayments because they will help you. Just call and say, hey, I'm in a financial hardship. Can you give me forbearance? Can you give me delays, et cetera, et cetera. That's number one. Number two, you're going to have these monthly payments over 10 years. There's so much. So we look at an income statement, income and expense. There's so much that we can cut our expenditures until we hit bone. Once you hit bone, you can't chop off your arms and legs. So the only way, what I think is, there's a limit to how much we can save. Because once I eat enough ramen noodle in a given week, that's it. I become gluten intolerant afterwards. But either way, there's so much I can cut before I have to say, I can't live like this. Focus on there's no limits how much you can make. You have this degree. This means you invested $100,000 in something great. You have some knowledge and you have some skill sets that you may not be truly valuing yourself to maximize that income. So what I would focus on is how are you going to maximize your income potential and monetize your knowledge and skills so that paying this monthly, debt is irrelevant. It's nothing in comparison to what you can make. So focus on that. Mm-hmm. So that's what I would encourage students to do. Mm-hmm. And then one thing we talked about having debt. Student loans is not the big debt that everybody scares of because that's after 6 months of you graduating. I believe in what I wrote in my book, Money Smarts, the gateway debt is actually auto loans. Because why? Once you graduate high school, the first big purchase is going to be your auto. And everybody is going to have a monthly payment. And what's interesting about these auto loans is the parent is helping them doing it, and they're not taking, and they don't even go through the process themselves. They don't even know what they're signing. Mm-hmm. So what happened is during the 4 years or 5 years or 6 years or 8 years of college, they need to trade time for money because they now have a monthly payment. Versus if they have bought a car that they can pay off, There's no monthly payment. So then instead of trading, forcing them to trade time for money to make these payments, they can trade time for knowledge and skills that's useful to the degree that they're actually getting in. So by the time they graduate, they can actually monetize their degree and not go and get a job or a career that's outside of their realm of expertise, and which a huge, vast majority of graduates are doing. They're pursuing careers not in their major. Because of what? Necessity to make these monthly payments. And these monthly payments is what causes them as a gateway debt. So if I would encourage, one thing is parents encouraging college students not to have monthly debt payments. So that way they can focus on trading their time for more knowledge and skills and internships and not for making these payments.
So we've heard practical examples. Yeah, I totally agree with this. We've heard practical examples of what to do with the debt. But now here's a couple of practical examples for what you need to do in order to maximize your income. Be aware that education as such is not going to be your ticket to a well-paying job. You will need to work your asses off on many other fields in order for you to actually be able to become employable, in order to be able to ultimately perhaps even start a company. What happens is actually in schools, you're learning theory and you're getting a foundation of your knowledge. You need to still build something on top of that foundation. And typically in today's day and age, this is not done with school projects, but this is done with after school volunteering and everything that expands out of that. What I encourage all our students to do is very simple. Think about what you're good at and try to go deeper into this skill and then find an opportunity that you can monetize. Even if that is at first a really silly sounding idea, it is enough for you to get the expertise required so that sometimes later, when you're going to be sitting at that job interview, you can essentially tell your future employer, I've been in your shoes. I had to pay at the end of the month to cover all my costs. I know how a difficult decision it is for you to hire me. And then that means that even if you don't start a company, you're going to be 10 times more employable, and that's going to give you a head start. So what we need to do on a broader level is very simple. Schools should be aware that these practical skills like salesmanship, like being able to write emails effectively, it's that simple, how to enter the job market, those skills are at the core of the needs for the future generation. And I honestly agree with you when you say student loans are not a problem, but only under the condition that we do a good job educating these kids, which again, I believe that right now we are not.
And I would just add on the student loans, the biggest problem is when kids don't finish college, but they take out the loans. And those are mm-hmm. the folks that are struggling the most and where you'll find the biggest problem. So would you like to
That's
add
the
on
second
to that?
Biggest problem.
Okay.
The biggest problem is for-profit colleges.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I agree with that.
We communist of you.
Which are simply for-profit, they're not really colleges.
They don't.
And they are student loan-generating factories at outrageous rates of interest.
And so since we're talking about problems, just one other problem that hasn't been mentioned today that I think is a scourge on our society, and that is payday lenders. And this is something that, I'll be honest, you know, when somebody mentioned this word to me, was maybe 8 years ago, and I didn't really know what it was. And then I felt really stupid because they're all around us, but particularly in any low-income neighborhood, they're on every block. And they used to be nationally regulated, but they're not anymore. And so, like in Colorado, we did vote last time for a limit. I think it's about 33% is the maximum interest. That's probably the lowest in the country. I don't know that for sure, but it probably is. I can tell you that there are places in the South where they're allowed to charge well over 1,000% interest. And so these are short-term loans, and now you can do them on your computer, and you can fill out the application in the evening, and the next day the money will show up in your account. And you haven't read everything that you've agreed to mm-hmm. when you did that. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is one of the things that is really hurting our communities probably more than anything else, and it hardly ever gets discussed.
And I want them to talk specifics. I'm just going to make one comment. In Slovenia, the maximum that you can charge in interest is 10%. Everything over is loan sharking. Quite similar most throughout Eastern Europe. And the problem I don't see as the necessity to regulate that, but what you said at the beginning, that we have an unequal society where there are people that have no other choice to take it. I don't believe anyone wants to take it. And I think that it's a necessity and a last resort. So we should be focusing on solving the problem, not basically dealing with the consequence right now. Now you can be super specific to it.
Well, I'm not going to be that super specific. I agree with you completely that we need to reorient our society so that so many people don't, frankly, need payday lenders. But we need to re-regulate and much more heavily regulate them. Part of the problem with payday lenders is that most people, right, are completely oblivious to it, and the people who need it don't understand the implications of going to use it because we don't regulate it. And it is just part and parcel of what leads to widening income distribution in the United States, right? There are a wide variety of things that prevent people from climbing up the economic ladder. Right, one is financial illiteracy. It lets you get in trouble with you know, essentially loan sharks, you know, institutionalized loan sharks. Another is consistent hours across the weeks. Right, and a lot of low wage jobs, your schedule is going to vary all over the place. And if you have a child, that's going to be really difficult. So people will have to leave their job. They get fired because there's always somebody else to take it. We need to regulate the circumstances of our lower income populations much more than we do, and that may not start, but it really, really has to involve payday lenders.
Yeah. From an entrepreneur's perspective, I always look at why. Why would payday lenders business industry booming? Mm-hmm. It's because people are money stupid. If people are money smart, payday lenders would got out of business. Number two. Going back to the statistics, people are more open and parents are more open to talk about drugs and sex. Just imagine a student is struggling financially, don't know, or I would say are not aware of their options, are too embarrassed to talk to their friends and family, people that care about them. Mm-hmm. Then they go to these institutions that prey on the fact that they're financially ignorant, and they want to save face because of pride. So how do you combat that? Make financial education part of everyday discussion. Make it the norm. So that when students or young adults have financial troubles, then come back. And as a dad of a 3-year-old and 1-year-old, I would measure hugely on my success if my daughter can come to me first if she ever has any problems. Mm-hmm. I would consider that hugely successful. Mm-hmm. If I can maintain that level of relationship with my daughter, yeah, that if she struggles with anything in life, she can come to me for that question versus some payday shark guys. Mm-hmm. And I'll share with you so part of my book and game, I also created a game, and part of this game was we roll the dice and you pull a card, and the call says, hey, congratulations, you're now a parent. So because of that, they have to change their income statement and their expense side. That every kid that you roll the dice, if you roll snake eyes, you have twins. You roll three threes, you have triplets. And this time, this student rolled four fours. And each kid was $569. And he added up and was like, oh my gosh, I'm not having kids. And then the teacher turns to me, Nathan, you taught abstinence within a second. And I thought, you know what? The best way to teach life skills and life decisions is through money. I really think so. And so if we can just talk about life scenarios like this and humorize it, but make it very practical. Yeah, yeah, you can talk about abstinence through just money. It's very easy.
So here's a question I think would be worth spending a little time on. I have a little sister via Big Brothers Big Sisters with zero money for college. So this is young, very young. What is your advice for her?
When it comes to, when my parents and family and friends ask me, so Nathan, where do you want to go to USC? You know, where would you go to college? I said, USC. USC back then was $45,000 a year. That was 11 years ago when I graduated. And now it's $75,000. It's like top 10 most expensive universities in America. $75,000 a year. And they said, but Nathan, you know, you're on welfare, you're on free reduced lunch, and you don't have any money. Well, first of all, I said, yeah, I know, but I'm not going to let previous generations' financial struggle be my future. So I got to do something differently. I got to take on my own responsibility. I said, if I have to borrow money to invest in myself so that there's hope for the future, my generation, I'm going to do it. So it was that crazy mindset. The number one, I'm youngest of six. So if I fail, it's okay. There's five other siblings that can take care of my parents. So I'm going to stick out my neck and just do something different. I'm going to take personal financial responsibility for it and start asking, hey, if I can't afford it, what options do I have? And that led me to many questions like, oh, there's financial aid. If your family can't afford, there's financial aid and there's all these things. I'm like, oh, okay. And there's another thing. Scholarships. Oh, wow. I didn't know that. I'm like, okay. So I start going on. I Googled scholarships for me. It was, I'm not that smart. So that's what I did. Scholarships for me. And I went on. I applied to every scholarship that I can qualify for. There are some that says, if you're Asian with black hair, you qualify. Great. If you're short, great. I mean, like, all these scholarships. And I found out there's stats where there's so much scholarship money that goes unacclaimed, unapplied for, that I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to apply. So I applied to more scholarships than I applied for colleges. It's the opposite these days. You would hear students applying for 10, 20, 30 colleges and stress all about it. And then, oh my, how many scholarship opportunities or scholarship one or two? Flip it around. Focus on maybe apply to 5, 10 colleges and apply to 30, 40 scholarships. So I ended up holding the record for the most scholarships won in my high school.
Yeah.
And I ended up paying USC through scholarships. Mm-hmm. And it's also, and here's the biggest secret, and I want to share it to students, scholarships, even if you're a student right now, you can still have graduate. These scholarships, the money isn't the biggest prize. I won the National Scholar for the Horatio Alger Association. That back then was it was $10,000. Now it's $25,000. And I ended up donating that money back because by the time I graduated in a senior year, I was producing enough money through my businesses that I was able to donate it back because the value is not in the money. The value is in the mentorship of these scholarships. The people that give you these scholarship money, they have the heart and they want to mentor you. They'll inspire you. And for me, I would encourage that student to seek out scholarships and to never let money be an obstacle to achieve your dreams. Yep. Because you worked your butt off to get this acceptance letter, and because of the financial aid award letter or lack thereof, you deny yourself of that path. That is sad.
Exactly.
100%. And I want to emphasize that you know, financial literacy is not just knowing what compound interest is, not knowing what a mortgage is, not knowing what present discount value is. It's not just all those nuts and bolts. It's knowing that you have options, right? So Nathan mentioned, if you got a loan you're having trouble paying, call them, talk to them. Mm-hmm. If you don't know how you're going to afford something, do research, right? So we need to teach people how to do the research and that there's research to be done, as well as adding and subtracting and doing compound interest.
Definitely. And it's a super useful question because, like you said, you got the letter, now do something with it. The thing is, financial literacy alone is not enough. What you need to be teaching is the entrepreneurial skill as such, which means being proactive, looking for options, and hustling basically until you will achieve some way that people will help. What's really scaring me in my part of the world, but also here in America. Just last week, I was basically doing this master course for a small university here. And there were 20 students in the room, and I at some point mentioned, look, guys, I am personally the decision maker for an EU Erasmus grant that allows 32 people to come and spend 6 months on salary in Europe. Just come to me and get it. Nobody approached me. Even in America. I mean, it's a problem that happens across Eastern Europe a lot because we tend to be a bit more like lobsters, you know, hard shell on the outside, and you don't really want to explain and talk and these types of things. But the point here is, it's in the individual psychology that's more that you need to start. And just, you know, encouraging people to be self-starters and actually holding their hands through the first couple applications so that they know how to do it, and then basically staying on their asses until they actually really do with quantity what they maybe haven't been able to do with quality when they initially applied with their job description or whatever else they needed for college.
There are several questions about resources, and I just wanted to mention there's a national organization called the Jumpstart Coalition, and this is an organization that many, many kinds of organizations and companies that are interested in financial literacy belong to, and it's sort of a clearinghouse. There's a lot of information about curriculum for all ages. I've got several questions from teachers about that. I would really recommend looking that up online, and then, you know, you can always, their headquarters is in D.C., they're a wonderful organization. There is a chapter here, but I would direct you to call the D.C. office for more specific guidance as far as where to look. And there was another, same about students and a budget. Where is there a resource to show students how to do a budget? Well, you probably have quite a bit of information about that.
I'm gonna answer with the first one. I would say for the students that's currently in college right now, be friends and have relationships with your financial aid officer. They have what you call professional judgment. What that means is they can make a decision on how much they can give and help you just on their judgment. So as long as you can present your case of need or special circumstances, and so if you could just tell stories, talk, communicate, have confidence, wherever the case may be, convince them and don't let up, they'll help you. And the other thing too is financial support from the university can be negotiated every year. Yeah. So just because you're currently a student, you don't think you can't be friends and go back. So if there's any officers in here, just plug your ear. Just you didn't hear that. But yeah, be friends with them, talk to them. And they will give you more resources that's very current and most importantly relevant to what your needs are. In terms of budgeting, right now, just know that as you get older, life becomes more complicated and there'll be more things to manage. One thing about budget is the word track. I'll give you a very practical problem as to why budgeting is very hard. It's almost impossible if you don't do the opposite, which is, this is how much I want to save, and then reverse engineer everything else. If you want to do it to track it, it's almost impossible. I'll tell you why. Starbucks, you don't pay cash for it. You have your Starbucks gift card, or you load up on Starbucks app, right? It's the Starbucks. Starbucks have about $7 billion of your money. That's crazy. Because why? People don't trust themselves to keep their own money. They load up on Starbucks so that way they can buy it easier. And if we go out, we give gifts, load up on gift cards, and we don't ever spend it all. So 20% of all gift cards is free money to the businesses, number one. Number two, besides all the gift cards, Amazon gift cards, Starbucks gift cards, Target gift cards, how many different credit accounts do we have with every single retailer there is? And then when we talk about where we keep our money, how many checking accounts do we have? How many savings accounts do we have? To the point where right now, we don't even know where our money's at. We don't even know where we're spending it. And when it comes down to consolidating bills, we don't even know what's going on. I mean, to the point where if we could just go back to everything all cash, because right now there's a whole push about Amazon doing cashless registers, cashless society. Everything is on a phone. We're going back into the days of, what, Chuck E. Cheese and casino. Everything is chip. Everything is on a piece of paper. Everything is digitized. There's no more relationship with money. And so right now, an iPhone of $1,000 is no longer $1,000 to the student's eyes. It's $25 a month payment that you never see at all. But if you equate money with labor, a $1,000 iPhone is equivalent to 5 weeks of minimum wage part-time labor. Then all of a sudden you think twice about buying that iPhone. Mm-hmm. 5 weeks of minimum wage part-time labor for students. Trade for one iPhone. Instead, go on Craigslist, buy a used smartphone, not a dumb phone, just a smartphone, right? It's only, what, $100, $200? Pay it off. Very different. So equate money with time labor. And then the best way to track and budget your money is start with the end in mind. At the end of the month, I know I'm making $1,000 or $2,000 a month. I'm going to save and pay myself the profit of $500 or $200. And when it's ever left, it's what I have left to spend. That's it.
Well, I hate to do this to everyone, but we are at 12:59, and it's been a fascinating panel. I feel like we could go on for another hour and keep great ideas flowing, but we can't do it. So I'd like to thank all our fantastic panelists, and thank you for your fantastic questions.